isolation and disconnection were on the rise even before COVID, and they can be incredibly harmful to our health. Now, loneliness isn't just about being on your own, but it's about the quantity and, to a greater extent, the quality of your relationships. If you're a doctor or a busy professional working in healthcare, you might spend most of your day talking to people, but that's not the same as connecting with your colleagues over a coffee or a glass of wine after work. And with more meetings being moved online and teams being more distributed, we're losing those personal connections we took for granted before lockdown. This week, Dr. Richard Pyle is back on the podcast following his TED Talk to discuss loneliness and just how risky to our health it can be. It doesn't just affect elderly people. It increasingly affects younger people just out of university and entering the workforce. So listen to this episode to find out how we can cultivate better, closer connections with people and not just wait and hope for those personal connections to form by chance. If you're in a high-stress, high-stakes job like medicine and you're feeling stressed or overwhelmed, burning out or getting out are not your only options. I'm Dr. Rachel Morris, and welcome to You Are Not a Frog. Are you a doctor or healthcare professional in a high-stress role where the usual advice on productivity and managing stress just doesn't seem to work? Maybe you end up blaming yourself for not coping better or feeling frustrated that you can't change the bigger picture. We've just completely re-recorded and relaunched our Beat Stress and Thrive course for healthcare professionals. We've added new modules containing all the stuff that I've discovered on the podcast over the last 4 years since we last launched it. It's a self-paced e-learning course designed for people in high-stress roles, and it's based on our flagship Shapes Toolkit program. It will help you get some time and headspace, feel calmer and work happier. Hop on over to our show notes, click on the link and check it out for yourself.
I'm Richard Pyle. I'm a GP partner with a special interest in lifestyle medicine and cardiology. I'm a clinical lead for our ICS in lifestyle medicine, prevention and inequalities, and also I do a bit of work with some healthy lifestyle providers.
It's great to have you back on the podcast, Richard, because you've been on before talking about, well, I think sort of all things lifestyle and well-being. Is that right? A while back now? Or was it Ikigai that we talked about?
We did. Well, remember, it was, first of all, thank you, Rachel. It's lovely to be asked back to one of my favourite podcasts. And I say that not because you bribed me to say it. we did. What was it? Episode 94, I think it was, Purpose. And so, yeah, to come back and talk about something else that I think is equally important is great.
It's wonderful to have you back. And this topic is very close to my own heart. And also, you've recently done a TEDx talk on it, haven't you?
I have. I was very fortunate to be selected to do a TEDx talk. St Albans, I don't know if you know how it works, but TEDx is a sort of franchise, and it was St Albans' first go at doing a TEDx talk. So I applied. The theme of the day was on connections, and I said I wanted to talk about loneliness, and I was lucky enough to be selected. So, yeah, we did it in October.
So what was it about your take on loneliness that they were particularly interested in?
I think with TEDx, obviously, it's all about kind of educating, informing, and I guess to some extent they're looking for a new take on things, not something that you've heard a million times before. So I did give that some thought when I submitted my little application, my little audition. I thought that the angle I would take, which was the direction we went in the end, was comparing loneliness to other health problems in terms of its severity, which is how I came up with the title that loneliness may be worse for us than cancer, which I did back up with some facts, you'll be pleased to hear.
And that is quite a worrying statistic, really, isn't it? Let's just start there, actually, when we're going to unpick this. You know, why is it worse for us than cancer? How can that actually be?
Absolutely. It's a brilliant question. And when I first started looking at it, I thought my feeling was this probably stacks up, but, you know, can I justify it? Can I find the facts that will make that a fair statement? Because obviously when you do a TEDx talk, everything has to be fact checked and you have to provide references because you can't talk rubbish if you're going to do a TEDx talk. And the stats are actually quite frightening, Rachel. So, and now, you know, the talk has already begun to seep out of my brain. So I'm not now about to give you a verbatim recitation of my talk, partly because, of course, I'd love all your listeners to go and watch the talk. But essentially, I mean, the stats that I found included the fact that you're as likely in your lifetime to be faced with significant loneliness as you are cancer. The stats are roughly the same, which is one in two. That in the UK, at the moment, it's estimated there are 3.8 million people living with severe loneliness. And that's actually more than the number of people living with cancer, which is about 3 million. And the stat that really got me, as well as the most, which age group's most vulnerable, which is another thing that we could talk about. The stat that really got me is that if you take into account all the risks of loneliness and inflammation and disease, and we can go into that, your cancer may increase your risk of premature death by, depending on which study you look at, which analysis you look at, which you believe, somewhere between 25 and 30% increased risk of premature death, greater individual risks to your health than smoking, physical inactivity or obesity. And you read that and you think, I mean, the campaign to end loneliness, for example, will give you some of those stats. Just shocking. And yet we take cancer really seriously, which is what the talk was about, how we screen for it, how many lives it saves. And yet loneliness, a lot of people, including medical professionals who are my close friends, have listened to that talk and gone, wow, I never knew it was that big a problem.
So many questions. How do you define significant or severe loneliness?
So I suppose in terms of loneliness, I would say, as I define it in the talk, I would say it's simply a mismatch between the quality and quantity of relationships that you would like or need, and the quality and quantity of relationships that you have in your life. And I suppose, as far as I'm aware, there isn't a numerical scale which says if you score 6 out of 10, that's severe loneliness, and 4 out of 10 is only moderate. But I suppose my answer to that would be when it gets to the point at which, a bit like depression, it's beginning or is significantly impairing your life, your function, the quality of your relationships, your ability to perform at work, the things that you want to get out of life. I would say that, that's how we think about mental health, isn't it? We used to ask the screening question. Do you remember back in the days of QOF, people with heart disease or diabetes were asked 2 screening questions about depression, and then do you want help with that? And because it interfered with their lives. And that's how I would view the loneliness thing. If it's impairing you, if it's effectively disabling you, I would say it's severe.
It's interesting what you say about a mismatch between the quality and quantity of relationships, because my impression is, and I think that people who are very busy, who work very hard, are often very lonely. And I think a lot of doctors are very lonely, but we don't recognize it. Because we have the quantity of the relationships is there. You've got your colleagues, you've got your patients, you've got your family. But if the quality is really, really low, then you can be at risk of severe loneliness, presumably.
Absolutely. If you think about, you and I talk about lots of the topics we've got similar shared passions for. So, for example, the concept of blue zones and the Moai mates that people like Rangan Chatterjee and others talk about, that small group of people, typically 5+ people that you grow up with, have got your back, can lend you money, will be there in a crisis. Those are the kind of quality relationships that you need, I think, aren't they? And I'm careful to put a few caveats in when I talk to patients about that, because I think that relationships and connections are a little bit like food or exercise, other areas of well-being like sleep. You need the right dose. So some people probably only need 1 or 2 close friends. Maybe if you're a bit more of an introvert and you get your stimulation from within, you don't need validation from loads and loads of external sources. But if you're people like me, you might need a bit more. But it's the quality that really counts, because you could be surrounded by people and still be lonely and have no one that you can talk to when you're really struggling. And that could never be more true than in a busy GP surgery. We have 80 people employed on our team. And if you're not careful, you could get through a day just with a brief exchange of social pleasantries in the morning, maybe a coffee break, maybe before you go home, and you sit in your room all day and you see one patient after another. And it can be really tough. So yeah, it's quality and quantity. And I would emphasize the quality, I think, more than the quantity.
Totally. I remember when I was working as a GP, I felt very, very lonely in my surgery because, yes, there are other people around, but we were all working so hard behind closed doors, and you're seeing patients again and again and again. It's nice to see patients and, you have good relationships, but it's not the same, is it? And you might get 10 minutes for lunch and, like you said, exchanging pleasantries, and then you go off home and everyone's rushing around so much. And I guess for me, the way I managed that was having other roles. So I really enjoyed my teaching job at the university, because actually then I was sat in an office with the others and we were chatting and we were brainstorming about how we were going to run this particular seminar for medical students. And that was where I felt my deep connections really were at work, because when I was at the surgery, everyone is just getting on with the day job, which unfortunately, you know, the nature of being a doctor, you cannot sit in the same room as your colleagues and see patients. So I guess if you can sometimes if you're on telephone triage, but you know, because of confidentiality, privacy, you can't. So it can be a really, really lonely job. And I can imagine, I'd be interested in your take on this, Richard, as you're obviously still practicing GP. Post-COVID, that's got even worse, because we used to have meetings face-to-face with our colleagues where you could do the pleasantries. But now for meetings, quite a lot of practice meetings or PCN meetings, or if you're in a department or hospital, people just dial into those. They don't get in the same room because it's much easier, really. You don't have to travel and you can record them. But I'm wondering if that might be contributing to the loneliness people are feeling.
I think it could be. You're right. I think there are pros and cons, aren't there? So, for example, before COVID, I've worked for the CCG and now the ICS for the past 10 years. So like you, I've had a portfolio career. Before COVID, you spent an awful lot of time traveling to meetings that weren't always that great. And I would say the plus side of being able to dial into one meeting, and I'm not saying you want to do one meeting after another meeting after another meeting, but the ability to connect with people quite quickly and be environmentally friendly and not lose hours of your day is quite a good thing. But we do miss the face-to-face. I think being a GP, I was very fortunate. Although life was undoubtedly stressful, particularly in the early stages of COVID, when people just didn't know what to expect. It was kind of like, it felt like something out of a Danny Boyle film. You know, it was kind of a doomsday scenario, wasn't it? And the doors were locked and what was going to happen next? And we all had packets of drugs at home, whatever. Not illegal drugs, you know, antibiotics and that kind of stuff. Mostly. We actually still, I know that there's a misconception particularly if you're a reader of the Daily Mail or the Daily Telegraph, but actually we were still going into work every day face to face. And at the time, I didn't really think of it this way, but fairly quickly I began to think this is a massive privilege. My colleagues, my friends who are not doctors were sitting at home. You know, if they were lucky enough to have a spare room or a study in their house, if not, they were sitting on their, you know, their parents' bed or whatever, trying to do their life, their work remotely with minimal contact with their friends. I went in every day. I saw my friends. Okay, they weren't all my closest friends, but I saw my friends every day. We still kept up social contacts and we would sit and we would debrief at the end of the day. Because let's be honest, if we'd been sat in the surgery all day encountering each other at close quarters, having clinical conversations, making cups of tea, the idea that you'd just pack up and go home and you wouldn't sit and have a chat for 10 minutes is a nonsense, isn't it? So that was actually really good. And what's interesting now is that, so some things I don't miss. So for example, I haven't been in a CCG or ICS meeting face-to-face for over 2 years. Not one of the big ones, because they're all teams now. But people are now saying, oh, I love having a face-to-face conversation. So I try to offer that to my appraisees. Some of them really like that. Some of them request face-to-face instead of teams. And when I say to the senior appraisers on our mandatory training days, oh, yeah, I still do about 20% of my appraisals face-to-face, they look at me like I'm mad, because a lot of them are doing it remotely. So, yeah, I think it's a mixed bag, but working in a surgery is great. I can appreciate if you're doing a different job in the NHS, maybe you would still be doing it predominantly through a screen. And I think that does throw up challenges. I saw someone today who was really having a hard time, and she disclosed at the beginning of our chat that she was having a hard time because of a family member being very unwell. And I think it would have been easier to have a chat with her, to engage, to maybe comfort her a bit if we'd been in the same room. And all I could really do was kind of talk to her on the screen. Three other people were present, and send her a little message afterwards. So that was probably not quite so good.
It's difficult, isn't it? It has really altered things, I think. I don't think things were great in the first place, but it's got a lot worse. I was speaking to a consultant, I think a paediatrician, who literally had not been in the same room as the rest of the consultants in her department for 2 years, which is really, really, really tough. Going back to this quality of relationships, it's interesting because I've been thinking a lot recently about what makes us happy, like what fundamentally makes us happy. Is it going to be all the holidays or a new car or whatever? No, it's actually feeling good. And I was listening to a talk about someone who'd really identified what our key desires are. And one of our key desires is deep connection.
just like one of our key desires is to, you know, be fit and healthy. And it's interesting when we think about our health and fitness, which I'm thinking about a lot at the moment because I've broken my ankle again. And I was like, I just got into shape after the last time I broke it, and now I've broken it again, and my fitness is going to go. And I make a plan about my fitness. I sit down and I plan it, and I go, right, I'm going to do yoga once a week. I'm going to do tennis once a week. I'm going to make sure I'm taking time to relax and really care for my body. So I'm planning that out. That's one way of being happy and healthy. But if deep relationships is one of our key desires that makes us feel good, what am I doing to actually plan how I'm going to have deep relationships? Because if I'm honest, I just expect them to happen. I just expect them to happen with my friends, who I don't see as much as I want to. And I expect them to happen with my husband, who, you know, we would love to make a regular date night, and we should do. And that's on my list to do that. But, you know, if you don't actually make any effort, how are you going to deepen that relationship? What about my kids? You know, I'm not actually planning that. Why is it we plan other areas of our lives, but not our relationships and our connections?
It's an interesting question to think about, isn't it? It's you're right. It's a fundamental pillar. And just like when we last spoke, I said purpose, I think, is probably the most important pillar. I'll hedge my bet slightly and say I think connections are probably, if not the most, then equally important with purpose. And I think if we have purpose and if we have connection, the rest of it probably falls into place for a lot of us. And it is so fundamental. Why don't we plan it? Maybe it's because when life is going well, it kind of happens without you having to think about it too much, doesn't it? And perhaps in olden times, even, you know, even before I was young, those things happened more naturally because interactions all took place face to face, and life was less busy, less full on, less 24/7, less always connected, less distracted. Now, with all these things jostling for our attention, like a lot of other stuff in life, we've ended up in quite a default toxic environment. The food we eat isn't good for us. The sedentary lives that we're kind of accepting aren't good for us. And the lack of meaningful relationships and face-to-face interactions aren't good for us. And, you know, we have evolved to live in tribes, and we're not yet ready to live without them. You know, who knows, 10,000 years from now, obviously, you know, neither of us will be around. It may not matter, because maybe mankind will have survived to live at 400 degrees at the bottom of the ocean. It won't matter, you haven't got any friends, and you can eat whatever rubbish food you like because we've evolved. But the reality is we haven't evolved that far. We're still those people that need tribes and need connections. But we've very quickly moved into a world which is hostile to those needs. And so some of us won't thrive and some of us won't survive, hence my comments about cancer. So it's really important that we do plan those things. So, you know, I heartily recommend your what sound like some New Year's resolutions you've got there, Rachel.
Yeah, it's going to be very expensive because it mainly involves going to spas with my friends and nice restaurants.
If you need a letter from a GP, just let me know.
I think I need that, Richard. I think I will definitely need that. You know, like you say, our environment now isn't very conducive to that. The other thing I was wondering about is our environment now even less conducive to it in terms of social cohesion, you know, with the demise of people regularly going to somewhere to worship on a Sunday morning together, the whole community used to go, didn't they? I have found just my stage of life, my community, when my kids were really little, was very easy because school gates, school community, you had to take people on play dates. You would just naturally meet other people. And now, of course, they cycle themselves to school. So I don't do that unless I make the effort. So I guess it's a stage of life, but also we've just sort of lost our community centers. Like now, where do you go to get the deep connections if you don't have them? It's not immediately obvious to me.
And I think we used to be more plumbed into our communities. We were more connected where we lived. And now, as you say, that's less so. And you're right, things like nurseries and school groups offer sort of ready-made groups, but not everybody has that. And I think we're more connected digitally, but I think we're less connected in reality. And the stats do suggest, if you look at the Campaign to End Loneliness, or many other organizations that measure it, I try to stay away from using words like epidemic of loneliness. You know, I avoided using that term when I wrote my book, but there is evidence that it is increasing. And the problem is that if the evidence is that it's beginning to increase, by the time that we do anything about it, it's, you know, the tsunami will be upon us. And if we look back at things like COVID, you know, there was the initial shock of COVID and the disease, but then there was the aftershocks of all the mental health problems around that. And now we're seeing aftershock after aftershock with lonely adults, lonely children, isolation, people who've been raised in that environment. So I think it is, we haven't yet seen the worst of it. So it is really important to think about how can we restore those connections. And you make the point about communities. You know, I'm not here today to proselytize, to advertise for the belief in any one particular faith, but the lessening in some areas of the of faith communities and the importance of things like the church and other faith-based organizations being diminished, sometimes understandably because of, you know, history and all those kind of problems. If we denigrate everything about religions, for example, and other purposeful communities, then we lose that. We lose the good as well as the bad. We throw the baby out with the bathwater. And that is a real problem. As families become more fragmented, as communities become more fragmented, we all become more isolated. And so that's a real challenge. And I think it's important that we consider that. And when we come to talk about things like social prescribing, for example, which can be the sort of, if you like, the kind of modern day, I don't mean modern day religion, because religion can be modern day, but it can be a religion or a belief that people can quite happily get on board with and engage with.
I used to have a article from the Times on my fridge, and it was the top 20 ways to be happy. This was about 10 years ago. And number one was live close to where you work, which was interesting. Number two was go to church regularly, or mosque or synagogue or whatever your place of worship was. And there is a lot of evidence that if you attend a religious gathering regularly, you are happier for a number of different reasons. I'm interested in this relationship and connection piece. Are there differing types of relationships? What's the relationships we should really be focusing on trying to deepen? Because I'm imagining that not all connections are equal. Some will give you more benefit than others.
Absolutely. So one of the sort of analogies I make is imagining your relationships like being in the garden and doing some of your gardening. So, and I encourage people to do this in COVID. I remember doing a webinar on it. You might want to ask yourself, let's look at my relationships. Which ones do I want to nurture? Might need a bit of pruning, but I want to kind of grow them. Which ones do I want to plant? Because I recognize that there are significant gaps in my social circle, whether it's people that I can really talk to, whether it's people that challenge me, people that can support me, or people that I can support. And actually, which relationships do I want to weed out and get rid of? Because they're toxic, and like weeds, they kind of drain me and they take the nutrients away from the other relationships I'd like to nurture. So yeah, I think not all relationships are equal. I've known people over the years, this is just my personal thing, but I quite like to have deep and meaningful conversations with smaller numbers of friends. And when I've encountered people where the relationship's very superficial, and after you've met with them 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times, you realize you're never going to get any deeper. The conversation is always banter. And don't get me wrong, as a football supporting middle-aged bloke, I like a bit of banter, but only so much. And when you get to the point where you realize it's only ever banter, every conversation's an anecdote or a joke, it's exhausting. I mean, how much effort do you want to spend on those relationships? So it's fine to have a few of those scattered around, because that's sometimes how you manage relationships at work. But you want those few deeper ones. I think it was Johan Hari, I might be pronouncing their name wrong, who wrote the book about lost connections, who talks to, I know Roncon Chatterjee's interviewed him on his podcast, talking about something like home is a place where people notice if you're missing or if you're not there, or words to that effect. You want those people in your life.
There's people that really get you. I've heard the phrase recently, useless friends. Have you heard about useless friends?
No.
I love that. I think I mentioned it in a quick tip recently, but so many people, I think as you get older, as you get, you know, as maybe you're in more leadership positions, there's a lot of people that you know who are friends and acquaintances, you know, such as people you work with, might be your friends, but they're not useless friends, because they sort of have a stake in you being okay and you being able to deliver for the practice or for the business or whatever. You might, you know, people might want something from you. And yes, they're your friends, but they want something from you. And I just heard someone talk about it's really important to have useless friends that literally they're not going to benefit from They'll benefit from being your friend, but they won't benefit from you in any other way. Like, you're not going to give them loads of cash, or you're not going to look after their dog for them, or you're not going to, and I'm just thinking to Motherland, which is one of my most favourite series. Like, she's constantly trying to make friends so that they will look after her kids, or so that they'll do the school run for her and she can get in the car share, and she's just hilarious. But, you know, useless friends, they like you just because of you. They like hanging out with you just because you. I think, oh, those are the ones that I want.
I really like that. I'm wondering, I've got a WhatsApp group. We're called the Manly Men, and we meet up every few weeks. We're not terribly manly, to be honest, but we meet up every few weeks, and I'm going to tell them all that they are officially useless friends and see how that goes. I'll let you know.
Very good. What's the most manly thing you've done in that group, Richard?
Well, you usually consists of meals and having a drink, but in fairness, we do weekends. We do a weekend away every year. We had to break for COVID a couple of years. So we did one very manly day, which involved paintballing, laser questing, go-karting, and drinking beer whilst having a barbecue. That is the most manly I have ever been in my life.
That is so manly.
Yeah. But I'm trying to compensate for something, obviously. Yeah.
I remember when I was doing the Redwell Lead Manage Thrive courses, in a break, this absolutely lovely GP came up to me and he said, because I've been talking about connection and resilience, the wellbeing factors, and he came up to me and said, I just want to let you know that I'm now 62 and next weekend I'm going away with my young practitioners group. He said, which I have been in for the past 35 years. And every year we go away for a weekend and it's just wonderful. And it's literally the thing that has kept me in general practice and has kept me sane. And I just thought, that's such a wonderful story.
And I know we're not leaping straight to the top tips yet, but exactly the same for me. I was invited to join a young practitioners group when I was young, which was 23 years ago. We're having dinner together tomorrow night for our delayed Christmas meal. We always do it in January. And we've now been going away for 24 years for a weekend away. We're doing Dubrovnik this year. And that I think has helped some of us stay in general practice. We have shared bereavements, the ending of relationships, issues about fertility and child rearing, you know, something we might dump under the bracket of sort of, you know, nervous or near nervous breakdowns. It's been a really, really helpful group, and I'm very grateful for that. And you know, we're not young anymore, but the young thing, that's what concerns me, because one of the things that I talked about in the TED talk is one of the questions I asked was, do you know what the loneliest age group in society is? And I haven't primed you for this, Rachel, but would you like to have a guess?
I think 48.
People do say your 50s are tough. The answer is, and I promise you I can back this up with the relevant research, 16 to 24 year olds are the loneliest age group in society. They are actually lonelier than people in their 70s and 80s. And the point that I make in the talk is that you could be frail, elderly, sick and bereaved, and yet objectively still feel less lonely than people that would be, you know, you would assume are in the prime of their life. And that's just so important, both for people of those age, but also I guess when we're thinking about, you know, younger doctors who've just started work, you know, it can be a really tough time.
Do you know why that is, Richard?
I mean, I think there's lots of speculation around it, isn't there? It is a time of life where you are quite naturally going through an awful lot of change, physically, mentally, and of course your life circumstances. You're going through, you know, secondary education, maybe higher education, maybe not, job, leaving home, asking the big questions about life and what's really important. And I think now when you throw in the isolating effects of social media, and I don't like to, you know, bang along about the toxicity of social media every single time I'm on a podcast, but, you know, that is undoubtedly contributing. And of course, these young people, 16 to 24 year olds, a big chunk of their lives has been affected by COVID as well. You know, you and I, even though we're very young, obviously, only a small proportion of our lives has been affected by COVID, you know, 4% or whatever in my case. In my 18-year-old's life, you know, 2 or 3 years of his life, which is a big chunk. So I think for all those reasons, you know, maybe they've always been the loneliest. I don't know, but I think it's certainly more of a challenge than ever.
Certainly have noticed that, you know, my daughter's just left school as well. And I think there is something about the fact that at least at school, you're thrown together. You have to be together. You have to meet people, and it's dead easy. As soon as you leave school, it's so much harder to meet people and get to know people. And then you go to university, and a lot of university is online as well. So you're not mixing and meeting people in the way that that you used to. So that's a really sad statistic. I said 48 for a reason, obviously, but
I wasn't going to ask a question, Rachel. It would be impolite on a podcast.
It would be impolite. But I have noticed that, and I know there'd been a lot of talk particularly about, and obviously I'm thinking you might be able to answer this, middle-aged men, Richard, but I think you already have talked about that there's a lot of banter. Often people are leading companies on leadership positions, so you don't know which ones are really your friends and which ones are just sort of tolerating you. And you've put so much time and effort into your work, and this is true for women as well, that often you've let the friendships slide because they're not the people that are calling out to you. And then suddenly you realize that the only people you actually really know are your wives' friends or the people that maybe I don't know. So I wonder if that's going on. But I do think doctors slip into it quite quickly, because I know, my dad was a GP. I've been in the GP, and I remember my dad coming home from work when I was little, and he was so busy that he just, all he could do was, on holiday, he just wanted to go away as a family and not see anybody else at all. And there is that thinking that I've been so busy today, I've seen so many people, my energy is so drained that I cannot see anyone else today. And so that is, to me, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So you're not seeing the people that you really need to see to build up those deep connections, because you're so exhausted from the draining connections that you've had.
And I think friendship and connections are about giving and receiving, aren't they? So in that situation, you might feel, you might benefit from being in the company of somebody, whether that's your other half or just your friends or whatever, of being in a situation where you can just relax. There's not a lot of expectation of you. You aren't required to hold forth and be funny and carry the conversation and organize loads of stuff. It could just be you're just sitting down, relaxing, having a drink, going for a walk together, because there'll be other times when you're giving and they're receiving. And I think people do make a mistake, because I think we all need people. The question is just what the right dose is. And it's probably a dose response curve, isn't it? Like, there's a dose response curve for exercise. There's a dose response curve for sleep. I know people who are so driven, have such FOMO, that they have a massive number of, in quotes, friends. But the risk there is that sometimes they end up squeezing out those relationships which actually are the most supportive to them and the most meaningful. And it's only when they then get into difficulties that they realize that some of those friends have drifted away.
I get it. You're pushed for time. And with over 200 episodes, how do you know which is going to be the one that lifts you out of the saucepan and back to thriving at work? Never fear, the You Are Not a Frog podcast quiz is here. Find out if you're a super squirrel, brilliant badger, or mighty mole, and I'll send you a personalized playlist with the top 5 episodes that will make the biggest difference to you. Discover your top of the hops, top 5 episodes, sorry, and leap into your happiest, thriving self again. Just go to youarenotafrog.com/quiz. I always think that the people who you get on with the best, who really get you, are often not the people that are crying out for you to see them. Or connect, they're busy themselves and they're not going, oh, please, I've got to see you, where are you? But the people, and sometimes the people that are a bit more draining are the people that say, oh, I need to see you, blah, blah, blah. So you do end up ignoring those people that are the sort of main energizers for you. So what suggestions have you got?
I think I would probably break that down into kind of on a patient level, perhaps, because that's what we have to think about as GPs, but also for ourselves, because I believe whenever we talk about well-being, whenever we talk about lifestyle medicine, clearly, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. We shouldn't ever ignore the doctors in all of this, as well as, and what's good for them, what's good for their patients is good for them. So from a clinical perspective, I now do ask people much more than I ever used to about their connections. And sometimes it becomes apparent, actually, that might need addressing before you start going down the route of talking about eating well and, whether you're doing, 150 minutes of moderate intensity activity a week. And we've got, you see it very particularly in, I know we can't call them frequent flyers anymore, can we? High intensity users, or whatever the correct, politically correct term is, in our surgery. The reason that most people, and the ones, by this, I mean, the ones that ring up every day or at least every few days, they're lonely. That's why they ring. They are lonely 99.9% of the time. And some of my doctor colleagues take the view, oh, it's all right, I don't mind chatting to Mrs. So-and-so because it helps them, whatever. And that's kind of them, but actually doctors are a massively expensive resource, aren't they? So I think we should inquire about relationships. And if we sense that, and people confirm that one of the key sources of their stress in life is lack of networks, lack of connections, then we try to help them, signpost them in that direction. And social prescribing is brilliant for that. And I mentioned this in my talk as well. Social prescribers, interestingly, you and I know about this. I would imagine most doctors know about it, but loads of people who went to the talk came to chat to me afterwards and said, social prescribing, I've never heard of that. What's that about? And I just put it to them very simply and said, it basically, a social prescriber is someone, or the movement of social prescribing is about helping people to understand what matters to them in life, not just what's the matter with them, and how to connect to that. And then with the right support and guidance, because obviously some people do need a lot of support and guidance, helping them to take back some control in their lives, which can be, otherwise very difficult, challenging and even chaotic lives, so that their lot in life is improved, their happiness is improved, their health is improved. So I recommend referring people to social prescribers, and every GP practice or primary care network has got one or more social prescribers in it. Most practices have got one. We've got volunteer social prescribers as well. And they've been trained to be able to talk to people, to listen. This goes back to the three L's of loneliness that I talked about in my talk. So look, listen, and lend a hand. So look for people who are behaving differently. You know them. Something's off. They might be angry, they might be isolating themselves, they might be using drugs, including more alcohol, they could be self-neglecting. Listen to them, because again, we both know that if you let someone tell you their story, whether they're your friend or your patient, and you don't interrupt them, and you listen carefully, they'll tell you most of what you need to know, just without you even having to fire questions at them and break up the whole process and make it unwieldy. And then there's the lend a hand bit. And that's, we can do that as friends. We can do that as family members. We can sometimes do it directly as doctors, but also we can signpost people to the people like social prescribers who are really good at lending a hand, because they know all about all the different networks in our respective communities, all the different services that people could take advantage of, gardening, walking, dancing, learning together, support for carers, financial support. So I think that's a big one for patients, for us to, and of course, we can take advantage of those because we're all patients too. And then I think when it comes to the professional side of things, I think it's the same thing. It's looking for people in your practice. When you go in the morning and you make a cup of tea, there's the usual social exchange of niceties, isn't there? Hi, how are you? Yeah, I'm good, good. You? Yeah, fine, thanks. And sometimes you haven't got any more time than that because you arrive late, you're first on triage doctor, and you've got to jump on the phones and you actually haven't got time to chat to someone for 10 minutes. But I would encourage all of us to think about, get there 5 minutes early, talk to someone maybe that you don't normally talk to or that you haven't had a chat to for a while. Make it clear with the way you look him in the eye and your body language and when you offer to make them a cup of tea that you are genuinely interested in the answer. And if they are in that moment wanting to open up, give them those extra few minutes, or arrange a time when you will chat later on in the day if it's better for both of you. And I've learned, some quite significant things from people I would have had no idea if I'd just gone. And it's amazing how crap people's lives are, and they will still go, how are you? I'm fine. You? Yeah, I'm fine too. I mean, I used to say that when I'd been up all night with my son Luke and the ambulances had been called because he'd been in status, and that, so it's amazing what people can put up with. So I would say that's really important. And then I think thinking the bigger picture, how are you doing in your surgery? I've just done a well-being survey for our surgery, which, okay, is motivated by the quality improvement domain of the quality and outcomes framework for which we get, incentivized. But some of the answers I've had back from that are really interesting. And a lot of them around mental health and stress and dealing with loneliness. And so we're going to put on some talks, some more team building, some social activities to kind of address some of these issues. So off the top of my head, those would be some of my answers to your question that you asked quite a few minutes ago.
That's great about, how do we help people? I mean, how do you inquire about relationships in you can sort of work it out in a bit of a roundabout way, but, without going, are you lonely, Richard? Or, have you got any friends? Without it being a bit clunky, are there any good phrases that you could use?
there are actually official loneliness scales. There's the UCLA 20-point scale, and there's even something called the 5-point alone scale. It's a bit sad, a bit sad title, isn't it? But the evidence that I looked at said asking one question when it's been validated by the experts is probably just as good as just using a complicated scoring system. And actually, it was more or less the question that you just asked, Rachel. It was, do you often feel lonely? Not just do you ever feel lonely, because loneliness is natural and part of life, and it's to be experienced and learnt from, just like many other unpleasant experiences in life are. We should never be afraid of that. But it's, do you often feel lonely? Now, you're right, I wouldn't lead with that. Hi, Rachel, how are you? Do you often feel lonely? But I think if you know someone, that's easy because you're having conversations with them and you can build up to asking a question like that. If I'm sat in a consultation with someone, I might ask something like, who are the significant people in your life? You know, being connected to others is generally considered quite important for our well-being. What about your connections? You know, are you happy with the quality of your connections? Have you got enough? Are the ones that you've got deep enough? Are there any ones that you'd rather not have that might help improve your quality of life? And then from those conversations, you could lead up to the, do you often feel lonely question, which I think that the comparison I would make is, we used to worry about this when we were first junior doctors, I'm sure we all did, asking people about suicide, suicidal ideation. You know, you wouldn't leap straight in with, have you thought about killing yourself? But you would work up to that. How do you see the future? Is there hope for it? Have you thought about harming yourself? Have you ever thought about ending your life? I think you lead up to the loneliness question, but you shouldn't be afraid of it, because if we don't ever find out the answer to that question, we risk having a patient who is lonely, who therefore gets the fight or flight response in their body, who therefore becomes inflamed with, you know, raised levels of inflammatory biomarkers and all that kind of stuff, who therefore goes on to develop non-communicable diseases, by which I mean things that you can't catch. So whether it's cancer, going back to the cancer thing, diabetes, dementia, depression, heart disease, strokes, rheumatoid arthritis, they go on to develop long-term conditions. And all those conditions, they're all called different things. They all have different diagnoses. They all appear in a different part of the diagnostic manual. But the reality is that most, if not all of them, have the same root cause. Maybe there's a bit of genetics and trauma and other things in there, but a lot of them have the same root cause. And a lot of them, if we're really practicing lifestyle medicine, could be reversed or improved with the same simple approaches to life. So if we don't honor that, if we don't ask people about loneliness, we're taking the easy way out. It's easy to let them leave the room and give them some fluoxetine, isn't it? That's what a lot of us have done historically.
So what you're saying, and I'm glad you covered that, the reason loneliness causes these problems is because you've got raised cortisol, because essentially you haven't got your tribe that causes stress. So in the same way that stress causes all these nasty non-communicable diseases, so does loneliness cause that. And I'm thinking, I think the reason doctors don't ask is because we don't like, in general, asking questions about something if we've no idea what to do about it. And that's what we find, you know, with in our training, lots of people shy away from asking these like really personal or difficult questions because they think they've got to fix it. We get into this, oh, well, if I ask the question and then they say, yes, I am lonely, I can't fix that. And I guess the one thing would be, it's just like you said, listen, you say, well, you know, what could you do? What do you like doing? What is it that's worked in the past? You then go into coach mode rather than rescuer mode and just find out what's been working for them, presumably.
Yeah. And I think also, if we don't ask the question, we're not getting to the root cause. So again, this is one of the things I finish off the talk with. We do worry about it being a can of worms. We might think it's not our job as doctors, with waiting rooms full of all the lonely people. But if we don't ask those questions, or we don't give people the space for someone to ask those questions, even if it's not us, although I think initially it can be us because we know the patient, we're in the middle of a conversation, why would we duck that? Then what we're doing is we're saying we don't really want to address the root cause, but we don't mind some slightly rubbish symptom management with some drugs that don't really work very well, but we don't want to address the root cause. But it's a head in the sand moment, Rachel, because then we're not practicing prevention. We know prevention is better than cure. There was a study that showed that people who were referred into a social prescribing scheme were 24% less likely to need an appointment with their GP. 28% less likely to need an appointment with their GP, and 24% less likely to attend the emergency department. So that, as a return on investment, if we start talking in financial terms that will prick up the ears of the chief financial officer of the integrated care system, that is a massive return on investment. So it makes no sense to duck it. I do appreciate in a pressured 10-minute appointment, you might not have time to address it, but it could just be the start of the conversation. And then you either get them back to talk to you, or you refer them on to the social prescriber. And like with our friends, if we have that rushed conversation and we're both going opposite ways on the school run or someone's catching a bus, just come back to it, you know, follow up on it. Don't miss that opportunity. Once someone's opened up to you, it's kind of a, it's an invitation to continue the conversation. Then you've got a foot in the door.
I wonder if we avoid it a bit though with our friends or people we see on the school run or whatever, because again, if you talk to someone about, you know, well, are you lonely? What, who have you got around you? Whatever. We then feel beholden to help. If they then say, well, yeah, I am really lonely at the moment. I don't have anybody around me. And we're like, well, I'm already up to my neck in helping people. I haven't got any time.
I appreciate the challenge. There is some evidence to show that, hence it's the, what is it? The 5 ways to mental wellbeing that the NHS talks about, or the government or whatever. Helping other people is one of the ways to mental wellbeing. You know, most people, I agree, you could take it to extremes, and there probably are some people out there, I suspect they're in the minority, but there probably are some people out there who could do with cutting back a bit. But helping other people improves your own well-being and your sense of connectedness. And also, it's a two-way street, isn't it? So hopefully, if you've got good relationships that you've nurtured, sometimes you'll be helping others and sometimes they'll be helping you. And you asking other people and being open about when you're struggling invites other people to be honest about that themselves. And when they help you, they're also helped. So I would argue that it's not as bad as it sounds. And generally speaking, most people probably end up better connected for it.
I totally agree. It's interesting when we do our training around wellbeing, and yes, we do use those 5 ways to wellbeing, and giving is definitely one of the ways to wellbeing. But we get people to rate their connections, and we say, you know, what connections that you have that really re-energize you, and then try and see those people as much as possible, or basically have a strategy for how you're going to see people. And then people are like, well, does that mean that people that don't re-energize me, I just dump? And we're like, no, not at all. You don't do that. But what you do is you move that from your connection bucket into your giving bucket. Because actually, if there's someone that really drains me, that I find, you know, I might like seeing them, but actually I feel net energy negative after I've been with them, then actually if I look on it as my interaction with them, and this sounds really sort of holier than thou or whatever, but for some period of time, maybe someone's going through some really difficult stuff and it's really difficult to spend time with them because you feel really drained and it's really difficult. But you look at, that's my giving time. That's my giving to that person. And it's in a completely different bucket. And I make sure that I go and have the connections with the people who at the moment really re-energize me. Then that will balance it out. And it just, for me, that has really helped me not get so resentful. So say if I've been out for an evening with someone that I have found quite draining, if I've been thinking, oh, this is going to be a really lovely evening, and you know, and then I come back feeling awful, then you just get resentful. But if you think, actually, this is an evening where I'm really going to give of myself to that person because they need it, and then you come and you feel, well, I've done the job, and that makes me feel good. So it's bizarre. It's about expectations, really, isn't it? And I guess there's something about managing your energy and actually identifying which connections you have that are deep and really energy giving and which are not, and which are actually very draining. I have heard it described. I think actually we did a podcast on this, on VDPs, VNPs and VIPs. Have you heard of those?
I remember listening to that episode, but I can't remember what they all stood for.
Very important people. So those are the people that really, really give into you. And the problem with VIPs is they're not that needy. So you could go for ages without seeing them, but you love seeing each other. It's like, so that is like, just get a regular routine of seeing them and meeting up, even if it's just once a year, like your young practitioner group. Then you've got your, so this was the interesting thing to me. You've got very nice people and very draining people. And the thing about very nice people is, there's like those people you're talking about with a lot of banter. They're really nice and it's quite pleasant talking to them, but you don't get re-energized by spending a lot of time with them. And the problem is, we can surround ourselves with just very nice people who it's pleasant to be with, but we think, well, why am I feeling not so energized? Why am I feeling that I don't have deep connections? Well, actually, too many VNPs in your life, very nice people, actually is net energy zero. Now, before I get any further, I want to say that I can imagine I'm a VIP for some people, I'm a VNP for some people, I'm a VDP for other people as well. So I'm not trying to say there's one category of people. You can be different things to different people, most definitely. before anyone just thinks I've got too high an opinion of myself. But you need to know who those people are. And I think we don't actually spend the time thinking, who are those people that I really need to see regularly? And who are those people that I'm going to be seeing, but that's my giving? And who are the people that actually it's nice to see, but I don't need to overload myself with seeing them all the time?
I think that's a really good way of describing it. And it's a bit like that. The surgery, as we don't all live in each other's pockets as partners. Some of us, we have a little meeting once or twice a week. At the end of the day, we call it the Parkbury Arms. We don't go to the pub. We sit upstairs and chat in the staff room. And some of those people I see outside of work occasionally, other people, just a relationship at work, but it's still a very positive one. So you're right. Yeah, we're all different. We're all VIPs or VNPs or VDPs at different times in our lives. And I suppose all I would say is it's give and take is good. So I can think in our lives where we've very much been taking, where we've been in receipt of kindness from other people who've really helped us at a very difficult time in our lives when we needed a lot of support. And in return, some of those very same people have been helped by us when the time comes. I would just ask the question, if you've got a friend that you've never ever been helped, a friend, a connection that you've never ever been helped by and is constantly draining and you're not quite sure about the point of that relationship, I think, it's good to give, but you might just have to consider, whether if you've got a finite amount of energy to spend, should you be spending it on them? Because sometimes people might need to learn from their behavior and the consequences for it. And, it might help them to smarten up their act and to be a better friend, possibly.
Yeah. And also, you can't be friends with everybody, and you're getting better with some people than others. I was thinking earlier when you said that the most lonely people are the 16 to 24 year olds, and actually often much less lonely than the sort of 70 to 80 year olds. And I think it's because when you're 70 plus, the evidence is, I think I've read it somewhere, you're really careful about who you spend your time with, because you're like, well, I've probably not got that many years left on this planet. Like, I'm not going to spend them with people I don't like. Or, bore me or whatever. Like, you have a much smaller group of friends, but boy, do you like them.
Yeah, I get that. I think also you've seen more of life. You're more certain about what life's all about. You've probably got a lot of connections because you've got maybe children, maybe grandchildren. Difficult when you're younger for all the reasons we talked about.
Yeah. Richard, but we're nearly out of time. I do want to ask you if I can imagine there will be lots of people listening to this that think, actually, I am quite lonely at the moment. I've got an incredibly busy job, an incredibly stressful job. I have very little time. I've got family, blah, blah, blah. I am feeling really lonely. Where would people go? What should people do? And how can they find some more of those deep connections that will really make them feel a lot better?
I think we should remember that in reality, no person is an island, and that no one truly flourishes by themselves. So however little time people think they've got, it's like saying, I don't have time to eat properly. I don't have time to sleep properly. I don't have time to have, meaningful friendships. That won't work. Ultimately, things will fall apart if that's the case. So it is definitely worth prioritizing. And we've talked about how it could be worse than even having certain illnesses. It's like when we talked about purpose on the previous episode, is giving yourself the time. Start with giving yourself the time to think about, okay, where am I? I'm going to give myself half an hour today just to think about this. Where are the gaps in my life? Do I feel well supported? Is it at work? Is it amongst my friends? Is it amongst my family? Are there some relationships that need repairing there? If those resources are available to me, I'll work on that. I'll work on developing those friendships. I'm not saying you go up to people and you say, would you like to be friends with me? But in reality, so think about it. When would somebody being friendly to you, showing an interest in you, having a chat with you and inviting you to socialize with them, would that ever be offensive? As long as they're doing it nicely, you can still make friends at any stage of your life, however difficult things might be right now, whether you're in your 20s or your 70s, you can still make friends, even new best friends. So it's definitely possible. And if you're in a difficult situation where maybe you don't have family around you or you live by yourself, think about, and this is really what we'd say to patients as well, isn't it? Think about the connections that you could forge. Think about the community where you live. Is there a community group in your block of flats? Is there a walking group nearby you or a running group? You could go to park run and make friends in the cafe afterwards. Do you have a hobby that you would like to either take up or rediscover, whether it's cycling, archery, painting, whatever? Because all of those things come with ready-made groups, and then you can figure out what you want to do. If you're medical, are you in a first five group? as a younger doctor. And if you never got the chance to join one, you know, look around your surgery, look around your peers. Are there people who'd like to join a group with you? And just start by saying, you know, why don't we do a, I feel really boring saying this, you know, why don't we start a journal club? Okay, I probably wouldn't say that. I'd probably say, do you want to go to the pub? But, you know, whatever works for you. So those are all things that I would think about. And also, you know, if you do have a faith, maybe it's something you might have drifted away from or you're not actively practicing, but, you know, that's something that you could re-explore as well. And people can be lonely even in a church setting. So it may be a question of looking at the groups within those faith groups, groups within groups that you could perhaps connect with. So those are the sorts of things that I would suggest. I think because people are made to connect, you will hopefully be pleasantly surprised, even if you're worried, that putting yourself out there does usually result in a bit of reciprocity and then a chance for you to decide which relationships you'd like to pursue. And maybe look for people who are not just the same as you. You talked about the people who are nice. I don't mean horrible people, but do you want friends that challenge you? Do you want friends who've got a slightly different perspective? You know, if you know, you've got a bunch of middle-class, highly educated, overachieving commuters as your friends, you know, who work in the city, you know, maybe you should be looking to have a slightly more diverse group of friends to make your life a bit richer and whose lives you could enrich as well.
Yeah, side note, I did read recently that you will become in character most like the, I think, three or four people you spend the most time with, which is quite worrying when you think about something, you know, if you literally, the only people you spend time with are the four toxic people at work. and I think, you know, if you are feeling stuck, then you can do no worse than actually just go and serve. Like they said, help out in a park run, volunteer at the food bank. Go and do something. And when people say, I haven't got time, well, it's, you do have the time. It's what are you going to prioritize in your life? And something that I've noticed in my own life is that it's really good to do something regularly. It's very hard to build up relationships when you only see somebody, particularly it's fine if there's somebody you've known for 20 years and you can just catch up with old friends. That is very different. But yeah, I do a regular circuit class and it's become, you know, with some mates that I've known for 20 years, that's wonderful. But there's some people that I didn't know before and actually, they feel like really good friends now, just from sheer regularity of seeing them. So they know what's going on in my life. So there is something about just persistence and habit and just being there and being known, I guess.
Absolutely. And I would add to that, all great points. I would add to that, the fact that when you join a group and you meet people, then they become people who can hold you accountable as well. Aren't they? So they notice when you're not there and they give you a call or a message and check that you're okay. And you turn up because even though you don't really feel like it, they're going running this morning because it's 1 degree and raining. You know that other people are counting on you or looking forward to seeing you. And that could be really helpful as well. Most things that you want to change in life when it comes to behavioral psychology, you're always going to do better if you socialize it and you do it in a group.
Right. So Richard, what are your three top tips for people? If you were pushed on your three top tips.
So my top tips would be, remember that we need to be in some kind of tribe to thrive, however big or small that tribe may be. And however much you don't think that's true, it is for pretty much all of us. So no one is really an exception to that. Take loneliness seriously, because it can be worse for you than many diseases and can shorten your life and make it less happy as well. So when it comes to you talking to your patients, think about that. And when it comes to yourself and the people that you are, your friends and family and loved ones and colleagues, and just bear that in mind as well. Be looking for it. Remember the three L's of loneliness. Look, listen, and lend a hand. And that's three, isn't it, I think?
You say we need to be in a tribe to thrive. Is it okay for your tribe to be your work? Or is it better to have another tribe outside of work?
I think there probably isn't a hard and fast answer to that. The only risk of having all your tribe in one place is that if you then get disconnected from that, say family separation, leaving your place of employment, you've suddenly lost your tribe. So when I say a tribe, my tribe's made up of different people from different parts of life so that it doesn't fall over if I suddenly move on from one place to another. So it's probably better to have, it's like almost like a spider's web, isn't it? The more connections you've got, the less likely you are if one or two of them are severed for you to then sort of fall out of the sky. So maybe not put all your eggs in one basket.
Thank you. That's helpful. Yeah, my top tips, I think, number one, habit and presence builds relationship. You know, just seeing people regularly can build those connections. And really, we need to be planning our deep connections. Just don't expect them to arise just because they are. If they are, then brilliant. But you cannot expect that, particularly as you get older and busier, I think. And identify who your VIPs, your VNPs and your VDPs are. And, you know, try and get the right balance. And the VDPs, put them in the bucket of giving. So the people that really drain you, just look upon your interaction as something a little bit different.
That's good. I'm going to take that one away.
You do. You do. So Richard, where can people get hold of you and find you if they want to find out more? And where, yeah, obviously we'll put the TED Talk in the show notes. Where can they get hold of you?
So all the usual social media things. I'm at Dr. Richard Pyle on LinkedIn and Dr. Richard Pyle on Twitter. My website's called feelgoodforlife.uk. And you can find my TED Talk on YouTube. Oh, and my book, Fit for Purpose, is linked to from the website as well. And you can find it on Amazon and all reputable bookstores.
And I was also going to say, if anybody wants to have a real think about their well-being, what we will do is put a link in the show notes to a toolkit that you can download. So I've got a Dials Dashboard Wellbeing Dials, which contain the 5 ways to wellbeing. So giving, learning, being active, eating well and noticing. Those are the 5 plus another 3, and you can actually rate yourself and think about it. So that's quite helpful. So, and there's some resources with that. So we'll put that link in the show notes. You can sign up and get that free download. And just remains to say thank you so much for being with us, Richard. It's just been wonderful. And we'll obviously have you back another time when you have your next TED Talk, right?
Yeah, it might be a while till I do that again. That's hard work. But Rachel, thank you very much again for the privilege of coming on the podcast. It's great.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget, we provide a self-coaching CPD workbook for every episode. You can sign up for it via the link in the show notes. And if this episode was helpful, then please share it with a friend. Get in touch with any comments or suggestions at hello@youarenotafrog.com. I love to hear from you. And finally, if you're enjoying the podcast, please rate it and leave a review wherever you're listening. It really helps. Bye for now.